I know it's not appropriate, but I'm going to say thank you so much for your article anyway. I don't want to interfere in our journalistic relationship. It really meant a lot to us, and it's really good that when there was where the hell is this film going to go? And nobody knew where it was going to go, so sincerely thank you, mate.
Now it can be told that Miramax was, as I said, say at the time, that Miramax was, of course, keenly interested at that
time. Oh, we can say, yeah. I mean, what happened was Miramax at Edinburgh.
Was
before Toronto.
Before Toronto.
So the nice thing about having Miramax as our distributor is they really wanted the film before it won any awards.
Okay.
But our producers had promised, and our sales agent, Robbie Little, had promised, and we can say all this now, I don't think there's a problem, had promised other distributors that he knew that he would not sell the film before Toronto. Mm-hmm. And so when Daniel Batzig made an offer in Edinburgh,
right,
before we'd even won the audience award,
yeah,
we sat one night in a cafe for about. Shall I move this Coca-Cola out of your way? see, vitamins.
Right.
I shouldn't be advertising. hello.
I don't like to use flash, so I can avoid it.
And you don't want me to look into the camera, though, do you? I know you.
So at the end.
So we sat in this cafe at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we were just debating this. And Robbie said, "Look, we just can't sell the film until we get to Toronto." And the fear was that when we got to Toronto, maybe the whole thing would turn the other way and critics would hate it and Miramax would withdraw their offer. And they, of course, what happened is we got the audience award in Toronto and suddenly we got more offers. And Batzig and Miramax hung in there and outbid the others and took the film. And I'm glad they did.
The audience award, in addition, at the Toronto Film Festival, in addition to the one at Edinburgh as well, yes? Did you also? Yes.
Yeah, so we'd won the audience award in Edinburgh before we came to Toronto, which gave us good buzz.
Right.
But as you know, we were sort of in the sidebar kind of on the last day of the festival.
Mm.
But at least that audience award, I think, generated an audience for the film. Some people said, wait, this film won Edinburgh, maybe we should go see it.
Mm-hmm.
But Batzig had already put in an offer before the audience award in Edinburgh, right after he saw the movie.
Mm.
Which I often thought, like, is this guy nuts? He's running this new company and he's going to take a risk of his first movie being a film in Tootsie Tal. And I was like, so I think he saw something in it that I perhaps didn't have the confidence to believe that it would do, you know, that it would appeal. And the truth is, we still don't know. Let's see what happens when the release happens on the weekend, but that it might appeal to a broad audience. And he believes it will. So I hope he's right.
I think I mentioned in the piece that I wrote when I'm. Person who is not caught up and sort of jaded about their in the film world as one could arguably say I am.
Right.
If one is coming at it from a somewhat fresher perspective, which is to say that, you know, you're not completely immersed in seeing everything, and you don't. And my friend, who is my host, said she isn't the most sophisticated film person, but she knows what she knows.
I remember that's what you said in the article, yeah.
And she wrote me 3 months ago because someone happened to see that and it got up on her. Anyway, she got insulted that I said that she wasn't the most sophisticated person. And listen, I swear, if someone were to tell me, Jeff, you're just not the most sophisticated baseball fan, I would say, I think you got a point. You know,
right.
Or you don't know anything about, or you don't know very much about golf. Right again, you know. I mean,
but you liked Tiger Woods' performance, and you say.
I think it really means something when a person who is not sophisticated watches something and responds to it on a gut thing. If I were Miramax, that would be the thing that would make me.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry she was upset. maybe we should try and find a word. That maybe it's the sophisticated. Nobody wants to be called unsophisticated in the context.
That
is just the word. Because I know what you mean.
Yeah.
But that's probably what happened.
Yeah. I mean, I
maybe one should say not a what would be the word? I don't know. A jaded expert in excessive film watching. But I knew what you meant, and I didn't take it the wrong way. I thought it was really nice the way you put it, but I'm sorry she responded that way. But I guess it was just unsophisticated. She probably thought you meant she was some sort of pleb from
like a bumpkin.
Like a bumpkin, anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, well, can you make it up to her on this one?
Try it.
I mean,
she's really nice to me. She hosts me every time. Let's we stay at her place. I've known her since high school. And she,
Did you explain to her?
Yeah, I tried to. Tried to say, listen.
And she went, you will camp in another place next time you come. I'm sorry, mate.
Fine.
Oh, dear.
The thing that we got into, that, and also the other thing I think that would impress anybody, was that you made very clear to me in Toronto that you made a deliberate decision not to go in the direction of City of God because you knew that you would... people would yawn if you did that.
Well, they'd think I was imitating, and I thought I probably wouldn't be able to do it as well as Moraes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the truth. I mean, you look at a film like City of God, which is done well, mm-hmm. is definitive in some way, and then you have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because what do? If you imitate it, you got to look like you're imitating it. Even if you imitate it really well, you're still imitating.
Mm-hmm.
He broke the rules. He achieved this extraordinary visual kinetic energy.
Right.
But as soon as I start saying that, I know that what I knew was I started saying, well, is this film set in the ghetto? That doesn't make it the same. It's like it makes it a film set in the ghetto, but it isn't about a whole lot of kids running around out of control that I can't keep up with, and therefore the handheld camera is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
It's a film about a one-on-one relationship being ultimately, although it starts with a gang, it's a young boy and a young woman. And there's a lot of stillness in this movie, and there's a lot, and one's frightened of that word because you think, does that mean boring? But the truth is, the novel was so much about what went on in the mind of Tsotsi, and how he was repressing memories or memories of his mother, and how he was trying to keep up the front of anger,
mm-hmm.
and how he was feeling disturbed by the questions that Boston's asking. And you can, the author beautifully describes his inner struggle. Well, unless you have voiceover, which is clunky, and whose voice would it be? If it's his, then he's talking too much. And he's meant to be a character who doesn't want to talk. So you're killing the mystique.
Mm.
So what are you left with? You're left with an actor and structuring scenes where that actor can reveal his struggle as small jabs are made at him, to which he seldom responds, but he's responding internally. And if you've got a great actor, that struggle is revealed through the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So what shooting styles you have? Well, first thing is you've got a handheld camera. You're not giving the audience the chance to really look at his eyes, really feel what's happening behind the eyes. And that firstly brought me to say, well, I'm going to shoot this with eye lines very tight to lens so that the camera can't be wobbling around because now you're aware that I'm here, the director.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want you to know I'm in the room. I don't want you to see my style. This is a film about... an inner journey of a character, not about, this is not, if you make Kung Fu Hustle, it is about style.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the movie's brilliant at. It's
right.
The style, it's the joy.
Right.
There's something appropriate for everything. I don't want to suggest this is the only way to make a movie, but in the case of Tsotsi, that's why I think we talked last time about feeling more inspired by Central Station.
Yeah.
By Walter Soros' film Central Station. There's a jaded older woman
right.
and an innocent young boy enters her world. Well, here we have a pretty angry young man and a three-month-old enters his world and then a young woman and these one-on-one relationships. And I looked at Solis's work, and if I stole from anyone, that's who I stole from, because his eye lines are pretty tight to camera, even in the opening scenes of that movie. And you're looking into the eyes of these people and seeing their inner struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the widescreen helped in two ways. It helped in the sense that this is a myth, or it's a mythical story, should I say. It's not a piece of documentary filmmaking. You are, in many ways, constructing a story that is designed to get to a place of catharsis or self-awareness of the main character. And that's a classical tale of a young person in search of who they are, who encounters various mentors along the way. And in this case, the mentors are a three-month-old and a man in a wheelchair and a woman with a baby and ultimately the father of the baby. And these various people unknowingly shift him along towards a greater and greater level of self-awareness. And it seemed to me that part of that sense of a mythic story is to be able to go to a big wide shot of the city brooding over him as he walks towards you on a railway line, and there's this indifferent huge metropolis that has formed him but doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just one little lonely figure of thousands, and that classic composition is designed to tap into that mythical kind of moment, where in the way that a handheld shot can't.
Mm.
And the other thing I liked was that you can reach across space on the widescreen. So when he and Miriam at the end of the film are sitting diagonally opposite at the table, you can be over shoulder on her, feel her, so that you're not getting in between them now. You're just backing off slightly. They are together. He's big and close up on the other side of the screen. She's felt on this side, and there's this empty space, and you just want them to reach across the space. And when you've got a tighter format, you can't play with those sort of visual metaphors. So given that it's a sort of mythic classical story, hey, can we play with some visual metaphors and use visuals to help us enter that world and yet at the same time be dealing with very real emotions? That was the risk we took in doing it in that way. But it seems to have paid off for most people, I think, fortunately.
I would venture to say that most people, most DPs, most directors, tend to think that a film would probably connect better if it's more visceral and more just exciting on its own, say, without trying to create or present visual metaphors, you know. Mm-hmm. And you, particularly, I love, you know, widescreen.
Such a beautiful medium. Yeah, and I think Lance did an outstanding job, Lance the DP, of, you know, given that we wanted to get behind the eyes, there's no moment in the film where you try to create a mood in the actor by shadowing his eyes and doing sort of, even though the style is quite noirish, I mean, there's a lot of mood and atmosphere, but never were the eyes not lit. So even when he's sitting in that shack and there's shafts of light, you just get so you can see what he's thinking. And that's, I think, fair to an actor like Presley, because he's delivering all the time. He doesn't need help in terms of, he needs to be seen.
Right.
Those processes need to be seen. He's not failing as an actor, so why try and find tricks to help create the mood when he's doing it? Rather draw everything towards those eyes, even the color palette. I don't know if we talked about this before, but for example, inside his shack, you know, the colors are limited to sort of rusts and reds and oranges. And believe me, initially, you know, it was like, what's the inside of the shack going to be? Is it going to be like lots of scruffy colors of posters of football teams on the wall and a lot of business and busy? And the feeling was that if we do that, you, the viewer, are going to spend wasted time trying to absorb this clutter when you should be getting back to him as quickly as possible. So let's strip the color down. Let's create the shelving and the little TV set and everything, but strip the color palette down so that you absorb that visual image very quickly and you go straight back to watching him and the baby. And in her house, the same. There were pictures on the wall. Take them down. We need the mobiles to stand out. We need her sewing to stand out. We need her to stand out. And we need him to stand out. And the rest of that room is a sort of pale turquoise, nothing that helps you just stay with them. So I really like the way the production design and the DP and I were able to talk about everything being about getting into this character's head.
Didn't I read, tell me if I, I apologize for not having a chance to do my research, but I just got down from San Francisco.
Okay.
Didn't I read about your next film being for a company here? A distributor here?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't locked a final film yet, but there have been a lot of offers, and it's a couple that have appealed to me. And I think, there's been a couple that are appealing, and to be honest, I don't know exactly what I'm doing next. I think the Tootsie's gone really wide, and now we're going to be marketing it in other countries for the next couple of months. But I think what I'm looking for in the next one, and the one that did appeal to me, which has been talked about, is the story of the prodigy, which is the story of the youngest university graduate ever, which is almost the polar opposite of Tootsie. I'm going to someone with no education at all to someone who is like 11 years old with an honors degree in nuclear physics. And what's fascinating to me about that is, again, it's a sort of story about trying to find out who you are despite the circumstances in which you find yourself. And the father figure in this particular story was this demented genius flamenco guitar playing man who felt he had the next Einstein, and he actually became paranoid at the responsibility and was so overprotective and drove the kid so hard that he ultimately drove the kid away. And the kid was then, the parents had separated, and the kid then goes to mother, who tries her best to do the exact opposite and give him a normal life and sends him back to high school. This is after getting a degree. Sends him back to high school, where he becomes a baseball-playing kid getting very average grades. And it's a story about a kid who's trying to please, He's trying to please dad, he's trying to please mom, but he doesn't know who he is.
I love that, so, going back to high school.
I know, yeah. That's true. And then he ended up working at Home Depot.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's just got married now. His dad has now died, and there was some release in that because he loved his dad, and his dad loved him. But it's this complicated need for love, which is in Tsotsi too, this universal need for acceptance, and what mask do you wear? And I'm almost scared to, I sound like I'm making the film sound the same, and they aren't, but maybe thematically they are. Maybe there's something about the struggle for personal identity when you've been born into circumstances that are not of your choosing, which is actually the case for all of us. None of us choose who our parents are, what our economic circumstances are. We don't even choose our religion. We don't even choose our gender. We just hear, and then we start making choices. And at some point, there's this, in the classic sense, a moment of epiphany where you go, my goodness, this is who I am. And it has nothing to do with dad or mom or my society or my religion or not. And you stay in the zone where you're trying to please people for the rest of your life.
How old is he now?
I have a young person in Prodigy. He's about 29. Yeah. So I'm nervous to say that it's happening because it's not necessarily happening, but it's just one of the projects that appealed to me that's been said. I mean, I've been sent a lot of other stuff, but I think what I'm looking for. And we've got some South African projects in development as well, and I'm just looking for ideas within a story that are somewhat universal. And, you know, this father-son relationship is something that many of us have tapped into in some way, and it transcends culture. And I think that that's what I'm most proud of with Tsotsi, is that it's, I mean, we just won the Pan African Film Festival today, I just heard, and the nicest comment we got there, I mean, I know I'm a white guy, so it's very nice to feel accepted as an African, the Pan African Film Festival here in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
Big African American Film Festival. But one of the comments that happened at the Q&A, and I don't want this to sound out of context, but a very strong African American man stood up, and I thought, whoop. What's he about to say? I'm a pale-faced African on the stage. And he said, I just want to tell you, I want to thank you for not making a black movie. And it was just like silence. And I went, what does he mean? And he went on, he said, because this movie is about people. And you put black people in a movie that's about people instead of them always having to be black people. And this movie can be made anywhere in the world. And he went on this whole speech. And then people started clapping. And it was a weird experience for me. And I was very proud of it. I really was, because and Presley was with me, the young actor, and the weird thing about him is, you know, he's a post-apartheid kid. He's, in some of these interviews, he doesn't get off the things like, why does everybody want to ask me about the race issues? Because he's got other issues at home about, you know, nationalistic issues, about being Tswana or being Zulu or being Xhosa, or what does that mean? And to what extent are we all South African? And to what extent do you hold on to your particular cultural heritage? Which is a bit like the European of it. Are you French? Are you German? Are you Italian? And for too long, people see black people in South Africa as all black people, as opposed to people from different nations, 6 million Zulu. 5 million Xhosas, 4 million Sotus, and they have their pride, and now they're South Africans, and it's like being European or American. Are you Italian American? Are you? So it's been quite a role in terms of, and I'm really pleased that people see it in that way. That I'll tell you one other funny story. Can I? On that same regard, a British guy at a screening.
Yeah.
I don't know if we mentioned that. I don't think it happened when I saw you in Toronto. We had a screening in England one day, and you know, and this man came up to me after the screening, and he said, "Very, very British chap, white. I just wanted to tell you how much I enjoyed your film, but I have to tell you, I was a little bit thrown, and it's rather disturbed me because, you know, I consider myself a liberal. I'm going, yes, but you know, I don't know many black people, okay? And so I was a little concerned that I was coming to watch this story about black people. And I wasn't sure how I'd react. And do you know that 15 minutes into the film, I forgot that they were black?" Which is like a bizarre sort of racist statement that's also incredibly brave.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what's been fun about the movie. Most people just take it as a story about a young person trying to figure out who he is, and I'm pleased about that.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's just me with the issues, you know, but I'm pleased. I mean, how did you feel that? Did you?
No, it's, you know, what got me, what got my friend in Toronto, is that it's about a horrid a monster allowing God knows where, you know, from baby but from other, for the humanity to gradually sort of poke out, and it's extremely touching because you believe, I believed absolutely, yeah, in the frozen, shut off, psychopathic quality of his being.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, you know, anybody who's 15, 14, 16, that's, yeah, you're going to be a monster.
That's the day.
Am I wrong?
Yeah.
Many of the killings, many of the drive-bys, they're by kids that age.
Well, they are, and I think that one of the things is that there's something terribly frightening about a kid with a gun, because you know they don't know who they are.
Yeah.
It's almost like, if I'm going to get robbed, can I have a professional, please,
yeah,
rather than some kid who doesn't know what he's doing?
He's going to do it for pride, for impulse.
Yeah, or just out of sheer rage.
Or rage at his father, no, that happened the night before, anything.
Exactly. And that, I mean, you know that I worked with these kids for about 3 years in the townships. When I was first out of film school, my first work was making what we called educational dramas,
mm,
for the Department of Health on low budget on videotape, right, in the townships. And many of these kids, I mean, that's where Butch is also valid, because every now and then you feel like you're looking into the eyes of someone who's just a psychopath. I mean, it doesn't happen often, but every now and then you feel this chill that says, I don't know how much discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a feeling that you sometimes get talking to someone in Beverly Hills. Just every now and then you feel, and that's the greatness of Hannibal Lecter. I mean, it's just the notion of a person with less conscience. And that kind of creature exists in many places. But mostly what you find is that the kids have got an image because they're feeling vulnerable and they don't want you to know it.
Yeah.
So that image in a tougher neighborhood is, I'm the tough guy and I don't care. And I've got to prove myself every day to the guys around me, or I'll get pushed down the ladder, or it's shy and completely withdrawn. And Sortie's in a sense a combination of both. He doesn't speak, because then he doesn't have to reveal anything, but it also, by not speaking, gives him a certain charisma. And he's figured out that gives him power. And then he's got Butcher to do the dirty work.
Right.
I mean, he doesn't actually stab a guy on the train, but he doesn't object when Butcher does. What he does is a moment when they look at each other, if you see, and then he looks at, what the fuck did you do?
That's actually the scene that won me over, because they're all silent and nobody says anything.
Yeah.
You know, and isn't it all pretty much...
Yeah. They don't say, yeah, nobody says. But then when Butcher actually does, because Butcher, on the impulse, Butcher has that nature, he just wants the excuse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what freaks Boss. Like, what the hell were you thinking? Because usually they'd mug guys, and when you point the spike, they don't speak. But unfortunately, the man on the train goes, hey... And Butcher wants that gap. It's almost as if he's looking for the gap to just put in the knife. And then the other guys have to pack around and solve the problem.
You know, it's interesting what you said about the Beverly Hills sociopath.
Yeah.
I think that basically you look at the New York Times any day, and it's about upstanding, college-educated, middle-aged guys, on the corporate level, admitting to, you know, obviously, you know, lying, usurping, the, you know, betraying the confidence of the stockholders
or the clients or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, the metaphor of that is that there's kind of like, well, it's me and what I got to get because of what I want, because of my girlfriend, my parents, whatever. And then there's the rules that I'll follow or the moralistic code that I'll consider.
Huh.
I'll definitely consider it. But it's not the main thing.
But it's not the main thing.
You know, and that's the... I think it's everywhere.
I agree.
You know, compartmentalization. It's the personality that Bill Clinton had. You know?
Nice. Interesting.
You know, you put it in a box, and there's that. Okay, but everybody's very reasonable. I don't know that anybody really lives by any hard and fast moral code, and there's a potential, and there seems to be evidence of what it sounds a little creepy to say sociopathic. Then it sounds Hannibal Lecterish. Then it sounds like someone who would do anything to further his or her goals. But I think that there's an elasticity.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like this notion that you can put things in boxes. It's not okay in this sense, but this is okay in this sense.
Yeah.
Moral relativism, as it were.
Moral relativism.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that, again, that's why I felt it wasn't just a local thing. I felt that there is an element of that kid, you know, in a lot of people. They feel the shut off thing. They feel.
Right. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, I mean, some people have said to me, you know, I'm not sure, like, he's so bad and then he becomes good. And I think, really? I think he's a kid who's vulnerable, who's got a mask, and all that we do is strip the mask away and reveal what was already there, which is the kid who was 9 years old when we saw him back there, and now he's blocked everything out. He's almost living in a sort of sensory deprivation. Don't let, because if you analyze this, you're going to fall apart.
Yeah.
And when enough things hit you, you do fall apart, and that's what happens at the end of the movie. He has a nervous breakdown.
Mm.
He's like, And he can't say sorry, but he wants to, but he also wants to say, please don't leave me. But it's everything. It's like, it's that breakdown that in some way, I don't know, but we've all had on some level when you lose a relationship or you lose a parent or you lose something where it's just everything's too much and it just doesn't seem worth it in that moment. And you just want to howl.
Right.
And you do it sometimes in private, but it's that moment of extreme vulnerability. And that's where we wanted to take the movie to. And I think Presley does nail it at the end. Between him and that exchange of the father. Because if he's too cool when he hands that baby back, you don't have a movie. And if he's melodramatic, oh, I'm sorry, and he doesn't mean it, you don't have a movie. So he said to me on that night, I said, am I going to say sorry? I said, Pres, you can't say. How can you say sorry? You got to feel this monumental remorse. And I'm thinking, are we going to get this? And he nails it, man. That when those tears pop and he's like, and he can't speak because there's nothing to say, then I thought we have a movie. And that's why I didn't want to do the ending where he gets shot. Because when you've got that scene where he stood on one spot and built to this emotional breakdown, if that isn't your emotional climax, albeit that nothing is said and two people do it in silence, if that isn't the emotional climax, no shooting him is gonna. It seems like you're cheating. It seems like you felt you couldn't get the audience, so you shot him so that they'll cry. No. And so the shooting, by the way, is on the DVD.
Oh, yeah?
I wrestled with where they have it on the DVD. But, yeah, you know, you might as well. I mean, we're human. We wrestle these things as filmmakers. We don't always get it right. I think that this is right, that the ending is right. But, hey, I mean, one of the things I learned so much from other filmmakers is watching the outtakes and the things and the difficult decisions.
Did you shoot the shooting after you were...
No, it was in the script. And we shot two endings.
Okay.
In the script, we shot him getting shot, and we shot him getting away. And you know what? I'm sitting there going, neither of these is right. And there's this moment that just was part of the shoot. He puts a hand up. What happens? The baby cries. And he goes for this bottle that he had. And and he goes to the bottle, and they think he's going for the gun. They shoot him. And he's like, you think, oh, it's a great, you know, it's a damn TV episode ending, man. It's not good. I'm sorry. And so I was like, we've got to get this out. And some people were very upset with me for taking it out because they had been devastated. It's not that his performance is bad. I mean, they're devastated. And in some sense, you know, and the camera goes over him, and it's as if his spirit leaves him. And some people found this, how could you take that out? But my feeling was that it stopped discussion. People were either devastated or they went, oh, for God's sake, I saw that coming Hollywood ending. And either is not good because they're not talking about what they've seen. Whereas with the ending that we have now, I like sometimes hearing some people say, that little bastard, I don't care how much you've shown me, should go to jail for the rest of his life. And I hear someone else going, oh, I want to take him home and adopt him. And I've heard both, and the answer is somewhere in between. You know? So, anyway, well.
Okay. Well,
it's so nice to see you again, and thanks for being one of our first supporters. It means a lot to us. It meant a lot to all of us when we read your article. Good. Not so much to say that.
Oh, you forgot that I'm allowed.
Thank you.
No, it's true. Bloody